Pratt Reel 5.
The next chapter in the story of your personal experiences was July 1915, where you were in reserve at Popperinge. Which trench were you in? Which trench system were you in at Popperinge?
Well, Popperinge wasn't the trenches. Popperinge was the sort of reserve centre, right away back, about 7-8 miles back from the front.
I see.
And from there, we went up to in July into Sanctuary Wood to hold the line there. And we were holding the line there on the night when they blew up, our engineers blew up Hoge Chateau. Terrific blast it was, made a crater about 700 feet deep. Mm. And we didn't go over the top at all. We just remained where we were in Sanctuary Wood, but we got very heavily machine gunned, in fact so much so that the parapet of our trench was getting absolutely crumbling to pieces with machine gun fire, and I had to get busy filling sandbags and clumping them on the top to build it up, and then got a bullet through my hand doing it. How it got through my hand and didn't hit me, Lord only knows.
Tell me a little more about this business of trench repairing. This must have been a pretty general activity. Yeah. In fact, what was the kind of frequency of this sort of work?
We were probably doing some all the time, and a good deal depended on whether there had been any shelling. Mm. If there had been no shelling, there was probably nothing to do. Mm. If there was shelling, even if a shell hadn't landed in the trench, it probably had damaged a bit of the trench, and you had to put in some more sandbags, or you might quite well feel, well, I'd be much better with a bit more head cover here, and you filled them more sandbags and stuck them on the top, you see.
So there were... there were variations in the kind of damage to the trenches, which you had to use different methods in order to rectify.
You see, up there at Ypres, you couldn't dig too far down deep because there was so much water. Even as it was in the middle of the summer, we were up to the knees in mud and water. And consequently, you tended, having dug down as far as you conveniently go, you tended to build up a parapet in front of you to give you the head protection.
Hmm. Were there any other kinds of idiosyncrasies of particular areas that forced upon you particular methods to deal with trench repairs?
No, I don't think so. I think it was sort of just the standard thing, and usually one didn't want to do any more trench repairing than was necessary.
Yes.
You rather think all the time of your own protection, how much is necessary to safeguard you.
Do you recall whether there were any different kinds of methods to deal with different kinds of damage to the trenches?
No.
You don't? Okay.
Invariably, the only thing was sandbags.
Yeah.
Fill sandbags and use sandbags to build up the protection.
One thing which interests me is the names that were given to the trenches. About this period, you were in two different trenches. One was Sanctuary Wood and the other one was Appendix. Yeah. I wondered how they got those names.
Well, the Appendix was easy because it wasn't Appendix. It was just a short little bit of the trench running out at an angle towards the German line where you came to a dead end about 20 yards from the German front line. That was called Appendix.
And Sanctuary Wood?
Sanctuary Wood was an actual wood, you see.
Yes.
It was a wood at one time, but the time we finished with it, there wasn't much wood left.
Mm-hmm. Another trench which you moved to in July 1915 was the Bluff. Well, why was that called?
The Bluff had been formed by the material dug out when making the Ypres-Comines Canal. There was a canal ran up there. They dug out the canal and the stuff had been piled up there and it formed a small hillock. Which is called the Bluff.
Yes.
And our trenches ran around there.
Mm. In this business of trench warfare, how important was it for survival to have trench experience?
Oh, it was quite important, because, well, you see, a young lad would come out, and probably, say, his first day, he would find everything peaceful and quiet, not a shot being fired or anything. He would start looking around, he'd start looking over the top of the trench, seeing everything, and then begin to think, oh, well, this is all safe. And next thing he knew, probably had a bullet through his head. So the point you had to make, you've got to keep under cover all the time. The Hun's probably watching, and so you may get away with it once. You may cop it later. For example, I had a case when I was in the bluff, when I went round behind our support line and found some fellows busy building a dugout. And the fellow was on the top of the dugout, putting down sandbags. And I said, what the hell are you doing up there? I said, making a machine gun dugout. But I said, aren't you in view of the German trenches? Oh, yes, he said. But he said, nothing's happening. I said, pull me up. So they pulled me up, and there we were. We could see the German trenches, three lines of them over a front of about half a mile. So I said, well, my God, the Germans are doing nothing at the moment. You'll be followed later on. I said, they've probably spotted you, and you'll have an artillery bombardment. Anyhow, he said, I'm going to finish the job anyhow. So I left him. That evening, they copped it. Fortunately, the first shell fell short, and he remembered my warning, and they all ran like hell. Mm. The next shell on his slab bang at the top of the dugout, and...
What other kind of skills or awareness did you develop once you became, well, what we might call trench-wise?
I suppose you developed a skill of sort of knowing the angles from which an enemy could spot you or couldn't spot you. And I'll put it the other way. You could develop the sense of where you were undercover or weren't undercover.
In the, again, whole business of trench warfare, was there much improvisation by frontline units? That is to say, did you develop your own methods to deal with particular problems?
There wasn't much you could do as a rule beyond the question of repair to your trenches, which I've already mentioned. The only thing that we tried, which wasn't actually done in the front line, was to build up a rifle battery. We had six rifles all mounted on a frame and directed on a point about 2,000 or 3,000 yards ahead, where we knew that the German transport would come up at night. As I said, no transport, both sides was horses and mules. And therefore, having sighted that very carefully, we would fire this rifle battery regularly, feeling it would cause great fear and despondency in the transport, who never liked being under fire. And that was about the only thing we did. So, of course, I remember now, one officer was appointed bombing officer. And the only bombs he had those days, that was before the Mills grenade, was a very funny sort of canister thing which you lit. And he got hold of an old-fashioned type of catapult, huge, big, wooden-type catapult with big elastic attached to it, rather like a magnified size of the ordinary catapult. And he was going to use this to throw his bomb at the German trenches. He lit the fuse of the bomb, which had probably got timed about 5 seconds or so on, then pulled the handle and ran like hell. Well, the first time he did that. Now, the only thing that happened was the thing burst in the trenches, blew the catapult to pieces and a bit of the trench. So that was the end of that experiment.
You mentioned on one earlier occasion the effectiveness of German snipers.
Yes.
I wonder whether, in your experience, there was any similar development of sniper units by the British.
Yes. Not until about May, when, after our experience with this German sniper, with obviously telescopic sights around it, Wichert, we appointed a sniper officer who picked about half a dozen men, one of whom was a padre already, to form a sniping group. And they did a very good job of work, particularly this sniper sergeant, about whom a book was actually written later, Student and Sniper Sergeant Forbes. He used all the camouflage methods, and he used to go right out into no man's land and do his sniping. Mm. Because one of the things you discover is that if you blend with the surroundings, not moving and so on, you can stand almost fully exposed, nobody will see you.
Did you see any of the camouflage he developed?
No.
You didn't? Did the sniper unit have any special equipment?
I believe one of them got a telescopic sight rifle, but otherwise they had just the ordinary equipment. But the training was really in trying how to cope with German snipers once you had located where the sniper came from. And there were ways of doing that by, when you got hold of turnips, put a turnip up on a trench, you see. The sniper will have a go at it and get a hole. Then put another one up on another point, you have another go. And by doing some little of that, you could get a very good rough idea as to whereabout that sniper was. Mm-hmm. And then with your binoculars, mm-hmm. you could, by watching that, actually spot his actual place. In fact, one afternoon, with one of my sergeants, who was a good shot, we discovered where a sniper was functioning. He was functioning from behind a loophole, which he could shut. And he was very cautious, because after he'd fired a shot, he would shut the loophole, and then he wouldn't do anything for about another 10 minutes, you see. Then he would come and open the loophole, then go and have another shot. So we waited for him until he'd opened the loophole after he shot, and then let go. And I think we got them, the first one, because as soon as that happened, the loophole was shut vigorously, and that was that. In fact, the thing we discovered afterwards is Hitler was in that bit of the front. We didn't get him.
Bad luck. Could have done the world a service there. We're now up to the period of August-September 1915, when your next operation was that at Sanctuary Wood.
Yes.
Where you did a holding attack as a diversion.
Yes.
For the Battle of Loos, which was about to begin.
Yeah.
Tell me about that attack and what your memories of it are.
This attack on September the 25th was going to be the big attack down at Loos. As you know, it was a guard. It was a very big attack at that time. And we, our brigade, I think, was put in to do a holding attack at Hooge and Sanctuary Wood, an attack which we advertised to the maximum possible extent with the intention of drawing as many German troops up there, making them think that we were trying to break through there. So we were up in the trenches in September. We were up in the trenches about the 11th or 12th of September to do some preparatory work for the attack, in which we were going to take part later on September 25th. Well, I wasn't commanding a company then. Company commander had come, my senior officer had taken over. But I was going out that night with an officer, a major from the North Lanks. We were going to go and explore some of the German trenches opposite us, because we were under the impression that a lot of them weren't occupied, you see. Well, it was my job that night to put out three posts in a big gap, 600-yard gap, between the end of Sanctuary Wood and Hooge Chateau, where we'd blown up. The first two posts I put up, and I was just leaving that when he appeared, walked down, and said, "Oh, the guard's a third post," which we had usually got to be very careful, because it was only about 10 yards from a German line, and the Germans sometimes got into it before us. He said, "It's all right." He said, "I just walked through it. It's empty. You can walk straight in." So off I set with my sort of seven men, well, my own battalion, I may say. And just as we got about 10 yards from the thing, a very light went up So on the camouflage, maybe just to an absolutely quiet, still, not a sound, not a move. Nothing happened. Then we went on, and I was leading. Then we dipped into the dip just before the post, when all these rifles blazed out in my face, hit me in the arm. I could see where they were firing, so I rolled rapidly away, and crawled out and got back, found the only one of the fellas left, the others had scooted. He was in a shell hole, peeing himself with funk, and I made him sort of help me back and back to my own line. Before I got back, a party from my own boys had come out and had picked me up. And then I got back into the dugout. The vet, we called him, Canadian vet, who was a doctor, came up and took hold of my arm. Oh, he said, it's all right, 9 series, no bones broken. And poured about several bottles of iodine into it and then yanked me off down to the line. Well, after that, my own lads got up, a hate party, about 6 of them, and they all went up, knew where the post was, they all crowned around it with a grenade each. Then somebody gave a whistle, they all threw the grenade at the same time, and they finally got in this couple of some Germans. So they got good revenge.
Mm-hmm.